welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we'll celebrate independent publishers, specifically the 20th anniversary of Seven Stories Press. We'll talk to publisher Dan Simon and author-cartoonist Ted Rall, who is an author of Seven Stories Press graphic biographies, including most recently one on Snowden, another titled Bernie, and most recently, Trump. Later in the program, we are joined by Arnie and Maggie Gunderson of Fairwinds Energy Education to discuss energy policy, the ongoing threat posed by nuclear power and nuclear weaponry in an emerging Donald Trump presidency. Please stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On the first part of today's program, we celebrate independent publishers. Specifically, we're celebrating the 20th anniversary of Seven Stories Press. We're going to be speaking here momentarily with the founder of Seven Stories Press, Dan Simon. And we're also joined by a fellow Seven Stories Press author, Ted Rall. And Ted Rall is twice the winner, the Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award and Pulitzer Prize finalist. He's a political cartoonist and opinion columnist, a graphic novelist, and occasional war correspondent whose work has appeared in hundreds of publications. Most recently, Ted Rall is author of a series of graphic biographies published by Seven Stories Press, including one on Snowden, one on Bernie, as in Bernie Sanders, and most recently, Trump. So certainly apropos for us to be talking with Seven Stories Press founder Dan Simon and author Ted Rall. Dan and Ted, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you, Mickey.
So Dan Simon, let's start with you. And this is an amazing history. Of course, Project Censored has been part of the history of Seven Stories Press since your beginning. Could you tell listeners about how you founded Seven Stories Press and tell us about some of the mission and the significance of that?
Well, I started in 1984, actually, so that's like a little over 30 years ago with a predecessor company called Four Walls, Eight Windows. Same publishing program, same philosophy. And it started when I stumbled upon, literally, because it was a sidewalk vendor on the Upper West Side in New York City selling me a book for a buck. And in that book was a story by Nelson Algren, the great Chicago writer. And the story was called A Bottle of Milk for Mother. And it told about a boy who was being grilled by the police captain about a murder. And there's a great line in that story where the boy at some point says, "I knew I'd never get to be 21 anyhow." And he had, in fact, murdered a guy. I can remember the electricity of the moment. The work was so good and so authentic. The voice was so authentic, and I'd never read anything quite like it. So it turned out all of his books are out of print. And I was just a guy, but I had started working in publishing. I was assistant editor at W.W. Norton at the time. And so I reached out to the agent, and she didn't want anything to do with me because I wasn't even a publishing house. I was just a guy. But eventually she kind of warmed to me. And after all, Algren's previous publishers declined to reissue his books because they were all out of print, she allowed me to begin publishing them. And it went well. And that's really the spirit that founded this company, and now we're kind of 600 books later. And I'll say just one other thing about it, which is at the very beginning, we did a lot of literary titles, about half the list, you know, literary works in translation, fiction from great American authors, and the other half was politics from authors like the Project Censored people, Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, Angela Davis, and that was the political side. And, you know, if I reached out both hands in both directions, I couldn't touch both walls. You know what I mean? They were completely separate. The political was half what we did, but it was completely detached from the literary side. And then over the years, those two things have kind of come together. And in my own mind, I consider everything we do, all the books, as works of the imagination. And you have to have a great imagination to imagine the world a better place and how you're going to make it better and to really kind of tell a story that way, just as you do if you're writing a novel. And so now I consider the fiction and the nonfiction as kind of two sides of the same coin.
Dan Simon, hi, this is Peter Phillips. I inherited Project Censored 20 years ago and did 14 books with Seven Stories Press, of which I'm very proud. But how did you get connected with Carl 3 or 4 years before and have the insight to see this as a very important series to be continued now for some 24 years?
Well, I remember I had a call from a guy named Mark Wimay, who was a sales guy at Publishers Group West, which was the great independent press distribution company at that time in the early 90s. This would have been probably 1992 or so, just after you guys had done the first book. And he thought it would be a good fit, knowing our philosophy and knowing yours. And he put us together, and then I met with Carl and Sandra, and you guys were doing a great job at basically monitoring the media and creating this place, if I can call it, which is where students and teachers and judges and journalists were meeting. And we thought we could add a lot as publishers and get it to people in book form and help with the editing and the kind of vision of it. That was, I think, the first one must have been 94 or something like that.
Well, 93, 94, right? And then Carl stepped out after a 20th anniversary in 96, and that's when Peter came in.
You know, besides Peter doing a great job, and then eventually Peter, of course, chose you, Mickey, another great choice. But the nice thing that happened that started with Peter was Carl got treated always with such respect as the founder. And so I think you guys always, as long as he was alive, Carl could see the project thrive and grow, and his voice was always heard by you guys, you know.
This partnership with Seven Stories Press has been long-lasting, and we certainly acknowledge that over the years now, say 24 books, 23 books, we probably sold 250,000 copies of censored books out there in the world, and that's certainly something that is important. Dan, what book have you had that is probably your top seller?
Top seller overall, I guess, in terms of number of copies, would be Noam Chomsky's 9/11, which we published just after 9/11. So we published it in early November 2001. But it was also arguably the most influential. And like many of our books, there's a great French publisher named Christian Bourgois, and he said something that I like, which is he said, the job of an editor and a publisher is to publish books that nobody wants. And many of our most important achievements and greatest successes were really like that. And when we started that conversation with Noam, really a few days after 9/11, we were advised strongly and in the weeks ahead not to publish that book. We all remember the country was very pro-war. There were yellow ribbons everywhere, and we were bombing Afghanistan, and it was a sign of kind of loyalty and love of country to be for all that. And our own business manager urged me not to publish that book, you know, that just nobody wanted it. Everybody was very happy to be, you know, standing behind the president and going after really the so ridiculous that, you know, the country of Afghanistan, which obviously were not the ones who had done 9/11 anyway, but we went ahead and did it, and there was such an outpouring of support, and it became the most influential post 9/11 book, and eventually even President Bush had to kind of respond, as he did in 2003, to the argument of that book, you know, when he would say in press conferences, "This is not a war for oil," and things like that. And it gave birth to really Noam Chomsky as a kind of powerhouse that people listened to. So that was very important, and it was very important in terms of our relationships with our friends, publishers around the world, the foreign publishers, you know, who bought that book, and it was a bestseller in Japan and Germany and so many countries around the world. And so it really stood for something. It stood for the America that was not represented by our government. And it was very important for other countries around the world to know that that America existed.
And Dan Simon, publisher of Seven Stories Press, you've always been fiercely independent, and you publish the books that other people don't want or won't publish, and you have such an amazing roster of people that you've published over the years. SevenStories.com is the website. And Ted Rall, you're with us as well, and you're on the Seven Stories press roster, and you've published numerous books, graphic biographies of your own with Seven Stories. You've worked with Greg Palast there. Your website, TedRall.com, people can learn more about you there. But Ted Rall, talk to us about your relationship with Seven Stories Press, particularly the most recent graphic biographies that you've done that have really taken off.
What's amazing to work with Seven Stories is simply the fact that you have so much freedom, not just to within an individual project, but to think about pitching projects that you know wouldn't even get listened to anywhere else. And it's not necessarily, as you guys have said, because they wouldn't sell or because there's no market for them. It's because there is an institutional and political bias against them at most other publishing houses. I had long wanted to do work with Seven Stories simply because I often found myself buying books by Seven Stories and thinking, wow, this book is awesome. This is the kind of stuff that I do. This is where I should be. Obviously, this is a sensibility that I think I would be comfortable with. But that said, it's not just about pitching the story, pitching an idea. For example, my most recent book, the graphic biography of Donald Trump, and previously there was Bernie Sanders, and before that there was Edward Snowden. But it's the process of editing, which is very intimate. I mean, Dan personally edits the books. There's not many publishing houses where an author can get that degree of involvement from the boss, and he's a masterful editor. You know, he brings stuff to the table that I haven't thought of, which frankly doesn't happen very much when I work with other editors in the past. Most of the time when you feed a project forward, you're lucky if they help you craft your ideas and your narrative into a format that works. But with Dan, it goes further than that. You know, there's a brainstorming process. It's very collaborative, and he doesn't get in the way of your voice, but he helps you think about things you might have missed and that needed to be in there, and to ditch, and maybe even more importantly, to get rid of stuff that doesn't need to be in there or is stupid. So it's really been an amazing relationship. And for the authors who are lucky enough to be with Seven Stories, if your goal is to reach people and change hearts and minds, or at least have the chance to change hearts and minds and be part of a public discussion in the public arena, there's no better place to be, really.
And Ted Rall, as you and Dan Simon know, Seven Stories Press just published our 40th anniversary edition, Censored 2017, Andy Lee Roth and I with Project Censored, and another cartoonist, Khalil Bendib, whom you know. Again, it's really a good combination and a synergistic kind of relationship in the things that we're all trying to do, and particularly in light of this very, very long election season and the recent outcome, I think it will have people reeling and having them go back and start really looking for more answers and explanations. And certainly the publications from Seven Stories Press really address a lot of those issues. I'd like to remind people you're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Our guests right now are Dan Simon. He is the publisher of Seven Stories Press in New York. And we're also speaking with author and cartoonist Ted Rall. After this brief musical break, we'll continue our conversation. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking right now with Dan Simon. He's the publisher of Seven Stories Press in New York, and it is their 20th anniversary. We are also speaking with author and cartoonist Ted Rall. To learn more about our guests and what they do, you can go to sevenstories.com or tedrall.com. And before the break, Ted Rall, you were talking about what's just been going on here in the United States with this election of Donald Trump. And Dan Simon, I wanted to take it back to you, and I wanted to talk to you about what is your vision right now. I know this is a very recent development, but what are some of the things that you're thinking, and where do you see Seven Stories Press playing a role in some of these current political developments in this climate?
I heard from a lot of people around the world, of course, the night of the election. People were sending almost condolences. The next day, it was really as if there'd been a coup, as if there'd been a major national disaster here. What I said to them is, you know, I feel not hopelessness, but very fatalistic. I'm just trying to process what that means. I think it's going to be quite difficult moving forward. I think a lot of the freedoms that we take for granted are going to start to be questioned. Of course, it's very galvanizing for me personally and for the press. There's so much to do. One thing that hasn't been talked about is, which is a little strange in itself, is the question of whether the election might have been stolen. I say that not as a conspiracist, but the New York Times and the Washington Post and the LA Times are not investigating this in the way that they would have not that many years ago.
Well, not like Greg Palast, Seven Stories Press author, or Mark Crispin Miller. I mean, there's some serious research going on there, and you've supported Greg Palast's work.
Greg Palast printed in late August in Rolling Stone magazine a very serious, credible investigation into something called interstate cross-check, which is really a very flimsy excuse by which 30 states were removing many, many thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of voters' names off the rolls. So, you know, that's one thing. It's almost like we live in an alternative media environment where there's no backstop behind us. It's not like we can do our kind of cool alternative stuff, always knowing that the New York Times is going to be there behind us investigating the serious stuff with crack investigative reporters, that kind of work. It's just not being done by the main newspapers and media organizations that really have the wherewithal, the skills to do it. So it's kind of on us to do that. I've spent a fair amount of time in the last few months writing to some of the managing editors at the major newspapers saying, whether this stuff is true or not, in your opinion, don't you want to put a reporter on it to see what they think of this stuff that Palast is unearthing? So, you know, that's one thing. I think I always look to the writers that we work with to kind of use their imaginations to kind of help us through moments like this. It does take imagination to kind of see into this present moment and beyond it. I'm actively reaching out to people. We don't want to do reaction publishing. I don't want to put together a book today about how terrible the Trump presidency is going to be. It's too soon. But, you know, Ted and I were talking about the timing of that. In about 3 months in, we'll have a lot of information. We're not going to read about that information in the New York Times and the LA Times. So maybe we'll need to do a book then examining the early days of the Trump administration. You know, we're looking at lots of things. And like I say, we feel very motivated and galvanized. You know, it feels good to be Seven Stories Press at this moment, let's say that.
Well, Dan Simon and Ted Rall, you published 600 books, Dan, and Ted, on numbers, and you've reached millions of people in the United States. And it certainly is an impact to sit down and read a full book on one topic, and we think very important. And we look forward to what you're going to be developing around the Trump presidency. And hopefully we're going to see an expanded book reading by people in the country as they question the validity of corporate media and certainly the importance of having independent press, truth-telling press like Seven Stories. That seems vital. And the idea that election fraud can happen in the U.S. must continue to be talked about. We have experiences of that. We know the 2004 election, 2000 elections were fraudulent. And there's aspects of that, but it's sort of like the corporate media doesn't want to talk about it, that we want everybody to believe the elections are safe and forward, when in fact, with caging and everything else that Greg Palast has talked about, that's really ongoing. So
Yeah, sadly, I think that's exactly correct. You know, what a horrible thing to have to say, but it's true. There's news that people have a right to know, and that the first responsibility of the major newspapers is to let them know, and they don't think it's their job right now. I do want to put in a plug for Ted's most recent book, which is this graphic biography of Trump. And one of the interesting things, maybe this is positive, is that in the months leading up to the election, everybody was screaming at each other, and Ted's book was honestly a bit too thoughtful, a bit too well-reasoned. It wasn't at the right kind of decibel level. But now, since the election, actually, we're seeing, as is, I think, natural and makes sense, renewed surge of interest in Ted's book, and I do recommend it to people. It's very thoughtful. It's very well researched. By the way, both of us predicted that Trump would win, despite what the polls were saying, and I think, you know, Ted's insight in his biography of Trump is something, it's exactly the right kind of beginning for people. Now, this is a long haul, and I would recommend that to people. It's a lot of fun, it's funny, but it's also the ABC of Donald Trump, and I recommend it.
Well, we also recommend it. We interviewed you, Ted Rall, on your Trump biography, as we did on Bernie and Snowden. Ted Rall, what are your thoughts connected to the book and the research that you did on Trump, given the election results?
I hate to say I think I was right, but I think I was right. It would be more fun not to be, actually. It's more of an interesting intellectual journey. You know, in the book, without giving away the whole story, I really draw a close parallel between him and Mussolini in that I think that Trump doesn't know he's a fascist. He doesn't think of himself as a fascist. He's more of an accidental authoritarian, as I labeled him in the book. He's a guy who's going to fall into actions that we're going to perceive as having a fascist tinge just by virtue of his own personality, which has led him to surround himself with members of a prospective future cabinet like former Sheriff Arapaio in Maricopa County, Arizona, who's known for his racist and abusive treatment of inmates and people of color, and Sarah Palin, Rudolph Giuliani, Newt Gingrich, Chris Christie. We're talking about not exactly pinnacles of shining virtue. And you can easily imagine a scenario in which they decide that they want to roll back civil liberties. They want to crack down. Not that these things are unique at all to a Republican president, as we saw under the Obama administration when they coordinated a crackdown, the Occupy Wall Street movement via the Department of Homeland Security. But that's what we're going to see. I mean, I think taking Trump's measure, you see a lot of his future presidency in the quotes that are in the book that come from the people that he grew up with and knew him as a kid.
If I can jump in, Ted said something I thought was a great analogy. Do you want to just repeat
sure.
that?
Sure. What I was saying is, they say Trump's not qualified to be president, and they said that about George W. Bush. But what they really meant about George W. Bush or someone like that, or Sarah Palin, is that they were going to be a terrible president. They weren't qualified to be a good president. But with Donald Trump, I suspect that it goes further. I suspect that, you know, it's kind of like if I became the editor of the New York Times, I probably wouldn't be a very good editor of the New York Times. But I could do the job. I just wouldn't be very good at it. But if you ask me to land a 777, we're all going to die. It's going to crash. I'll do my best. I really will. I care. I'll study up. But the plane's going down. That's, I think, what Donald Trump's personality is like. He's just constitutionally and mentally and emotionally doesn't have the attention span for this extremely boring, grueling job. I mean, anybody can just imagine, like, you know, having to meet with the head of the Kiwanis and the Girl Scout who sold the most cookies, like, you know, famous SNL skit about Reagan, or the lieutenant governor of Alabama to discuss flooding, you know, minute after minute, day after day. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And, you know, this is a guy who didn't even have the ability to think about who he would appoint to his cabinet before he won the election. He literally gave it no thought whatsoever. And now he's scrambling to do it. He does his life on the fly, and he's going to do his presidency on the fly. And, you know, sometimes that's great because you get out of the box thinking. I mean, we might end up with a big infrastructure bill, which would be awesome, shades of Adolf Hitler and the Autobahn. But there's going to be a lot of other stuff that will also be on the fly, like how to respond to dissent and people who resist his policies in the streets that may not be quite as pleasant. So it's going to come as a huge shock after 8 years of a president who, if anything, was way too measured to a guy who is manic. People have described him as a maniac. That remains to be seen, but he's certainly manic. That's for sure. We're talking about a guy who just doesn't like to study up. When he was at the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School of Business as an undergrad, his classmates recalled that he was a guy who was always into the get-rich-quick scheme, and he never did the work. He would always show up in class unprepared and always tried to his way through the exams and through the discussions. We've just elected as president of the United States, and that's not a very good character trait. Ronald Reagan famously demanded that every memo be limited to one page. I can imagine Donald Trump requiring them to be all limited to 140 characters.
Having said that, that's really amazing. Dan, I'm sure, Dan Simon, Seven Stories Press, I'm sure that you will be using some of your best writers, Noam Chomsky, Derek Jensen, Kaylee Lassen, Ralph Nader, and bring them forward and bring others that you're working with forward to address these issues as we go on. And, of course, Project Censor does that every year in a big way. And you were so helpful during the George W. Bush administration that where Dennis Liu and I published a book called Impeach the President, which you helped with. Perhaps, again, in a few years, that's what we'll be faced with making attempts to do.
Well, that's hopeful.
Dan Simon and Ted Rall, we're going to have to wrap up this segment, but I wanted to end with you, Dan, with some of your parting thoughts and, again, this very important anniversary for Seven Stories Press.
I would just say that the thing that's going to get us through all this is increased support for the alternative institutions that we have, Project Censored, the ACLU, and ramping up the quality of our relationships and the quality of our friendships. It's nice to be here with Ted because it's true over the course of half a dozen books together, we can kind of, you know, we're like an old married couple a little bit. I can tell the waiter what he wants. And without the fighting, right, we don't have to sleep together, you know. But seriously, there's tough parts to what we do, all of us. But the beautiful thing is that with time, these relationships get stronger, and we're going to need the strength of our relationships in these years to come.
Indeed. Dan Simon, publisher, Seven Stories Press. You can learn more at sevenstories.com. Ted Rall at tedrall.com. Thank you both for joining us today, and certainly congratulations to Seven Stories Press on this momentous anniversary. That was Dan Simon, founder of Seven Stories Press, together with author and graphic novelist Ted Rall, who's had several books published at Seven Stories. We're going to hear more from Ted Rall right after the musical break. Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We just heard a conversation with Dan Simon, publisher at Seven Stories Press, and author Ted Rall. Rall's latest work is Trump, a graphic biography of Donald Trump. This past summer, Ted Rall joined us on the Project Censored Show to talk about this book in the light of Trump's election to the presidency. We're going to play an excerpt from that interview. Again, it's Ted Rall, recorded back in July, speaking about Trump. Rawls' biography of the billionaire who's now president-elect. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we're interviewing Ted Rall. He's twice the winner of the Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award and Pulitzer Prize finalist. Rall is a syndicated political cartoonist, opinion columnist, graphic novelist, and occasional war correspondent whose work has appeared in hundreds of publications, including the New York Times, Washington Post, Village Voice, and more. For Seven Stories Press, publisher in New York, he's the illustrator of the full-length comic Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, How to Steal an Election in 9 Easy Steps from 2012, written by Greg Palast. He has also done several graphic biographies for Seven Stories Press, and listeners of the Project Censored Show will remember that we've had Ted Rall on the program to talk about his graphic biography of Snowden, Edward Snowden. We also had him on to talk about Bernie Sanders in his book called Bernie. Well, now Ted Rall has a new book coming out on Seven Stories Press, simply called Trump, a graphic biography. Ted Rall joins us by phone today to talk about the latest in his graphic series. Ted Rall, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks for having me.
So, Ted Rall, let's start with this. You have now this series of graphic biographies with Seven Stories Press, and you started with one on Edward Snowden, you went to Bernie Sanders, and now you have one coming out on Donald Trump, simply called Trump, a graphic biography. Could you tell us a little bit about how this started, this series of graphic biographies?
It originally started out as a response to the criticism that many of us on the left get, which is that we're always negative, not positive. And when the Edward Snowden story came out, I kept expecting someone else to do a biography, and they never did. And I kind of wondered why they didn't. There still isn't another biography about Edward Snowden, except for mine. And so I decided, well, you know, there's a hole in the market. There's this guy who did this positive thing. You know, here's a role model. Here's what you should do, as opposed to doing a book about, say, you know, the powers that be and saying, here's what you should not do as a person politically. So that book did well. It turned out, I thought, just pretty much the way I wanted it to turn out. I liked the format. I liked all that. And it sold okay. So we're looking to do a sequel, a follow-up of someone else who was positive and we could look up to. And my publisher and I, Seven Stories, we immediately kind of in the same breath said, hey, Bernie, there was no biography of Bernie Sanders in print. So we thought, okay, well, this is an opportunity to explain this guy's political and personal life. That book turned out to work out okay, too, and sold well. It was a New York Times bestseller. And so we thought that might be about it. I'm under contract to do another one. We thought it would be a trilogy. Pope Francis is next. But in the interim, Donald Trump captured the Republican nomination, as I suspected would happen. In fact, a year ago when this all started, I thought Trump would be the nominee and kept saying so, and everyone thought I was crazy. But obviously, my take on Trump politically is different than the other three personalities that I just mentioned. So I nevertheless thought that there's a lot of stuff about Trump's background that people aren't aware of, especially if they're not from New York City. I mean, I've been in New York since 81, and those of us who are New Yorkers and have been subject to sort of his real estate projects and on a more intimate level than maybe people elsewhere know some stories about him that other people don't know. So I kind of wanted to do a biography that would help put this guy into context. And, you know, I'm trying to be fair. I mean, you know, it's not all negative. I don't think it's a hatchet job. It's a fair look at this guy and where he's coming from and what kind of guy he is.
Well, Ted Rall, it's interesting you had mentioned your other two, Snowden and Bernie, in this kind of graphic biography series, Seven Stories Press. And you were mentioning about how particularly Sanders was more about issues than the individual. And in the case of Trump, well, perhaps he makes himself as an individual the issue, or the series of issues seen through him as a personality, which is certainly a different kind of approach to politics than we saw with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, well, it's definitely more of a negative character than the other three. And not to mention also, as you point out, it is all about personality in his case. This is a guy who, you know, he really has made his entire career out of bluster. And that's not just true in politics. It's certainly true in business as well. You know, there's for anybody who's familiar with the rise of Mussolini or Hitler, there's quite a few echoes there. More Mussolini than Hitler. But certainly the whole idea of the triumph of the will seems to be something that Trump absorbed not through reading history, but just sort of intuitively, that he could fake it until he made it. And he's been faking it until he makes it over and over again. So it's just a completely kind of an intriguing look. One thing that I was really trying to find was as much positive stuff as possible about him, because we're all familiar with the criticism, but obviously this is a human being. He's deeply textured, like all of us. There's a lot going on. You know, there's no way you can be in business and run a company and have a family and function in society unless you figure out how to get along with people. It can't all be just by yelling at them and humiliating them. So I wanted to find out what it was about his personality that does draw people to him.
Well, let's go into some of that, because, I mean, granted, you have some very choice quotes and things, and you've certainly researched deeply this topic, Trump. You've certainly also found some of these choice quotes, like, I'd like to punch him in the face, I tell ya. And in Vermont, confiscate their coats, it's about 10 degrees outside or negative 10 outside, when he's talking about removing protesters, his hostility toward journalists. We can talk about that here in a bit. But let's go back to this. What did you find, in your estimation, in Trump's background that you found to be positive?
He's very loyal. And he's the kind of guy, he's almost like a mobster, and he did have close associations with mobsters. But, you know, anybody who's ever watched The Sopranos or knows anything about the mafia knows that there's something very appealing about this idea that if you're in, I will look out for you. I will protect you. I will take care of you no matter what. So people who work for Trump tend to stay there for a very long time. He protects them when they screw up. He trains them. He's hard on them, but he's smart, and he likes to train people, obviously, in his own mold. But for people who respond to loyalty, I'm one of them, I'll admit it. You know, I'm big on loyalty. It can be very, very appealing. And you'll notice there's not a lot of turnover in the Trump organization, which is why there aren't a lot of tell-all accounts of people dishing about this guy from the inside. And if you think about it, that's pretty remarkable. This is a guy who has lived his entire life in the tabloids, who went through two hideous public divorces, who's had a very public dating and romantic life. You would just expect there to be a lot more about him. But you can only attribute so much of the silence to fear. You would just expect there to be more lawsuits, more stories about him leaking out. And there just aren't. That's just one example. I also think he's a guy who's extremely flexible. His personality may not seem like that, but whether it's in business or in politics, he can turn on a dime. As soon as he notices that something doesn't work, and we've seen it in this campaign, he will just dump it like a hot potato and turn 180 degrees and pretend like he never said what he said before. So for him, you know, you could say that's extremely opportunistic, which it is, but you can also see it as being the sign of someone who is able to turn and adapt, which, you know, for example, we have not seen with Hillary Clinton in this campaign. She has stuck to campaign planks that are unpopular and don't work. For example, her support for free trade. And, you know, they're only getting into trouble, and they may cost her the campaign. But, you know, she's not a flexible thinker.
Well, Donald Trump in particular, I mean, you mentioned about loyalty. He certainly has a classist sensibility about him. For example, he's not known for treating workers well. He certainly has outsourced to developing countries some of his brands, sweatshop.
True. I mean, I'm not talking about, like, the broad strokes of the thousands of people who work
right.
for the
You're
Trump
talking about his inner circles.
I'm talking about the inner circles.
Yeah, I get it. Right. Yeah, right. Well, let's talk more about, then, Trump as this candidacy. Recently, there's been some mumbling about Newt Gingrich and possible shortlists for vice presidents and so forth. And I bring that up simply because Gingrich, with many problems of his own, of course, that we likely won't be getting into here. But Gingrich basically said that Trump wasn't a conservative, that he's more of an American nationalist. And, of course, commented in, this was just released by the Center for Media Democracy and ProPublica, that Gingrich was recorded in a meeting talking to conservatives about the Trump candidacy and basically bemoaned the idea that, you know, the guy speaks to people on a fourth grade level and that's part of his appeal. But how one takes a fourth grade kind of level of communication and transmits it or turns it into policy is, well, that's kind of up to anybody. That's an unanswered question. What do you make of some of that kind of commentary?
There's a lot to unspool there. I mean, I think Newt is right. In the book, I hat tip Pat Buchanan, whose politics were very similar to Trumpism and he speaks approvingly of Trump. But obviously, Buchanan had more of an intellectual basis and theoretical basis for his politics than Trump, who is, he's really a political id. And that's why I see a big parallel with Mussolini, who was also much more about the cult of the macho cult of action than other traditional right-wing politicians. Trump's certainly not a conservative in the typical sense. This is a guy who has called for higher taxes on the wealthy. He has called for a more inwardly looking anti-militarist, anti-war platform than even Hillary Clinton has. He traditionally has been on the side of LGBT people within his own inner circle, and recently said that he would have no trouble with transgender people using whatever bathroom they want at Trump Tower. Of course, he has also recently allowed the Republican Party platform to be hijacked by anti-gay forces. But I think that's not him. I think that's his inattentiveness, not caring much about the platform enough to have his forces pressure the people who pushed that stuff through. Now, I'm not an apologist for Donald Trump. No way, shape, or form would I vote for him. I think he's very dangerous. But important to say that he is not a traditional Republican. And in a sense, that's the crisis that he has caused within the GOP, he's a wake-up call to them that even Republican voters don't really care about traditional Republican platform planks like lower taxes for the wealthy and for corporations. They don't believe in trickle-down economics. They don't believe in these free trade deals that have been supported by both major parties. So they're kind of shocked to figure out that Republican voters haven't been voting Republican so much as they've been voting anti-democratic.
Well, we see similar patterns perhaps in the Democratic Party. We're certainly seeing that with the more neoliberal part of the DNC, formerly Democratic Leadership Council. The Clintons, of course, known well for their rightward lurch in terms of the Democratic Party. Well, that said, you know, we've been riffing around here and actually dancing around the F word, fascism, in some part. And you actually had brought up Mussolini and more of this cult of the personality. We continue our conversation right now with award-winning cartoonist and author Ted Rall. He has been working on a graphic biography series for Seven Stories Press. It's transformed into that. He did one on Edward Snowden and Bernie Sanders. Now he has a new graphic biography coming out on Donald Trump, simply called Trump, a graphic biography. Ted Rall, we were mentioning some of the ideological proclivities and talking about how Trump isn't a traditional Republican conservative. Newt Gingrich had called him more of an American nationalist. You've alluded to Mussolini a few times in terms of this cult of personality, and you have a great quote in your book from Mussolini, attributed to Mussolini at any rate, stating, "Democracy is beautiful in theory. In practice, it's a fallacy. You in America will see that someday." And then you go on at some point in the book about Robert Paxton and Columbia University history professor, his book Anatomy of Fascism. Could you talk a little bit about this? Because it's definitely a delicate subject in American politics. And due to the historical baggage of this term fascism with Mussolini and Hitler, it's sometimes hard for people to wrap their heads around the concept. I know Naomi Wolf wrote about this in recent years under the W. Bush years. But people have been reticent to really recycle that term. But here you're talking about it pretty upfront. Can you talk about that?
Also, part of the historical baggage comes out of the left-wing movements of the 1960s, where fascist became kind of a catch-all phrase for anyone on the right whose policies one disagreed with. But, you know, as usual, most Americans really kind of don't really know what fascism was and what it is. Robert Paxton really did write the book on this, and his entire career was centered around the study of these 20th century fascist movements and what they would look like today. And I think you can say that in many respects, Trump doesn't qualify. He's not, for example, a militarist. Militarism is key to fascism. However, there's a lot of other boxes that you can tick. There's, of course, scapegoating of ethnic minorities and other minorities. There's also, for example, calling all Mexicans or insinuating that Mexicans are rapists and killers while allowing that some of them might be okay. That's very Mussolini type. Less Hitler. Hitler was more of a purist in blaming all Jews. There's also other aspects, for example, the cult of the leader, I think, is maybe the one where Trump screams fascist. You know, one of his catchphrases is, "Believe me." And he says, "Believe me, we'll fix this. Believe me, we'll do that. Believe me, everything's going to be awesome." And there's no details. I mean, Hillary Clinton's campaign has been very frustrated, and so to a lesser extent has Bernie Sanders, because they're expected to draft up white papers and provide details that are not being asked of Donald Trump by the media. Donald Trump doesn't offer any details about what his budget would look like.
He offers few details about anything, really.
About anything. Like, for example, I was kind of taken by a study by civil engineers of what building the wall that he wants would entail. And it would actually be just a massively impractical engineering challenge. Not to mention financially, the odds are the thing would fall in a number of places. You couldn't just build it, which is kind of funny when you think about it, because a wall seems like not such a complicated thing. And it's like, you know, the details like, well, I'm going to have Mexico pay for it. Never once has he even implied how he would get Mexico to pay for it. Believe me, they'll pay for it. When he talks about the military, believe me, they'll do what I say. Believe me. Even if, you know, like torture. Well, several generals said, we won't bring back torture. It's illegal. Believe me, they'll do what I say.
Well, he's the reality show candidate in many ways. I mean, that's part of that personality.
That's right. Well, I think reality shows are, it would be accurate to say that many of these reality shows kind of have a fascist vibe to them. It's certainly an authoritarian vibe. I mean, look, there's no question this guy's an authoritarian. That, in the traditional sense of that word. Anyone who has visited Saddam Hussein's Iraq or any number of former Soviet republics knows what this looks like. Vladimir Putin in Russia, this is the, you know, there's a reason he admires Putin. He admires strength, and he admires the cult of the leader. And, you know, for the most part, America is fertile ground for this sort of thing because we don't have a very engaged civic culture. We tend to outsource our political leadership every 2 to 4 years. We appoint someone, and we go back to watching TV and working our multiple jobs to try to get by, and we assume that the political classes know what they're doing and hopefully won't screw things up too badly. Trump is perfect for that. He's saying, look, I'm your guy. I built things. I'm successful. I'll do for the country, for the state, for the government, what I did for my business. Don't look too closely at the business.
And Ted Rall, in your new book by Seven Stories Press, Trump, A Graphic Biography, you talk about Donald Trump, the person, and talk about his campaign to date. So, Ted Rall, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored show today.
Thank you, Mickey. Always great.
That was part of an interview we did back in July with author Ted Rall of Seven Stories Press. Up next on the Project Censored show, we'll be speaking with Arne Gunderson and Maggie Gunderson about nuclear energy, nuclear weaponry, and the Trump presidency. Stay with us. And now we are joined by Arne Gunderson and Maggie Gunderson of the Fairwinds Energy Education out of Burlington, Vermont. Arne and Maggie Gunderson, what are some of the things you're focusing on regarding Trump presidency, energy policy, and nuclear power? And I know you're working on something there on nuclear power and CO2 smoke screens, so you're doing a lot of different things. Can you talk to our listeners a little bit?
Yes, we're happy to. Thank you so much for having us on. There are a number of things with Trump's new energy plan that he is talking about, and he is saying that he doesn't care about CO2, and that's not an issue for him. But when we look at the other things he's saying about finances, he says he's a businessman and he wants to make America great again. Well, then it's renewables. It's 100% renewables because the nukes are overpriced. We can prove that. Building new nukes costs more money. It's financially not feasible. And adding to that, if he goes into the cost of drilling new shale and drilling new oil and mining coal, it's prohibitive compared to creating jobs in the renewable sector.
You know, it used to be that back in the old days, before Tuesday, November 8th, the nuclear industry was pitching itself as a savior for climate change, and the only way to prevent global meltdown was to build nukes and keep the existing ones running. Like, you know, Diablo Canyon has made the case that the world needs Diablo Canyon to keep running because of carbon dioxide. But now you've got the Trump administration that's saying that there is no such thing as global warming. That's a real dilemma for the nuclear industry. If the Trump administration sticks to its guns on that there is no such thing as global warming, the logical conclusion is that all of these old nukes should shut down because they're too expensive. What they've been lobbying for is this carbon credit. And I can't see how the Trump administration can give a carbon credit when it doesn't believe that there's a such thing as global warming.
That certainly is a perplexing issue to think about nuke plants and then Trump's belief that global warming doesn't happen. And it seems that he's really supporting the oil industry, that he's invested in that in many ways, in the pipeline going across North Dakota he's got a piece of. So all of that is a conflict of interest for him. Do you think, though, there's possibilities that he may have advisors that will be not only supportive of nuclear energy and link it to the overall use of nuclear power, but just ignore what he believes now. You think that's a possibility?
I don't think we can conjecture on that, but I would say he talks about his intention to bring jobs back to America and stop the offshoring act for corporations overseas and putting money overseas, and he is committed to stopping NAFTA and TPP. So if that's true, then, you know, nuclear plants, all the reactors themselves, the vessels and big turbines and all the pieces of heavy equipment are manufactured overseas. We don't have that capability. It would take decades to build it, where in a very short time, we can have new plants for solar and for windmills built here in the U.S.
Tesla, for instance, is you know, can build solar cells and batteries right here in the States. So if you really believe in building a job-based economy in the United States, why would you want to send all that money to China or Japan or Korea, where we're the only three countries that can build a nuclear reactor now? There's typical conflicts in his policy, but I don't think it plays out well for nuclear power. I'm sure the nuclear industry is trying to change its tune, but for the last 8 years, they've been singing one tune. It's hard to learn a new one.
We're speaking with Arnie Gunderson and Maggie Gunderson of Fair Winds Energy Education. You can learn more at fairwinds.org. That's FAIREWINDS. Arnie and Maggie Gunderson, you talk a little bit on your website recently about something called mixed oxide or plutonium and nuclear fuel for nuclear weapons proliferation. We've seen Trump already signal his interest in working with Abe, the conservative leader in Japan, also with South Korea. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's really frightening. What happens is every nuclear reactor that runs on uranium creates plutonium. Right now, Japan has enough used fuel, spent nuclear fuel, to build 1,000 plutonium nuclear bombs. And South Korea has enough for probably 100. What Trump said back when he was campaigning is that he thought it would be a good idea to counter the North Korean threat if the South Koreans and the Japanese made their own nuclear bombs. And then he also said, you know, America's got all these nuclear weapons. Why don't we use them? So it's a frightening situation, one, from a proliferation standpoint. I mean, he just said that our allies should be building nuclear weapons instead of being under our umbrella. And two, he's suggesting that it's okay to nuke somebody in war, which we haven't done since 1945.
Maggie Gunderson, do you want to jump in here?
One of the things he's talked about is a clean America, that he believes in conserving our wonderful natural resources and beautiful natural habitats. And he swears that the Trump administration is firmly committed to that. So if that's true, then you're not going to want to use nuclear at all and not want nuclear weapons, because radiation knows no borders. That's one of our taglines on our site, and we've done a lot of work on this. We have testing data from all over the world that shows the path that Fukushima Daiichi releases made going around the Earth three times in the atmosphere. And if he nukes someone in another country, that's only going to come back into our air, our food, our water. There's no way to stop that. The radiation isotopes don't say, oh, we're at the border now. Gee, we can't cross that line.
So, Arne Gunderson, let's wrap up the segment here. We have a few minutes remaining, and I want to have you tell folks, what are you doing at Fairwinds Energy Education right now, given the looming Trump presidency and the transition? As the transition team comes together, we're certainly seeing sort of a return to pro-fossil fuels, mining, carbon, and of course nukes will be back on the table, and we have an aging nuclear power structure here, and we're dealing with someone that just doesn't believe all of the science behind global warming.
Yeah, you know, starting about a year and a half ago, Fairwinds started to push this issue of the nuclear power industry claims that, yeah, we're awfully expensive, but we don't release carbon dioxide. And we showed pretty clearly that that's what we call a smokescreen. In fact, the money to build a power plant and the time it takes to build the plant is a lost opportunity. That money could better go to renewable sources. And in the the worldwide nuclear industry wants to build 1,000 nuclear power plants in the next 35 years. That's a nuclear plant every 12 days for 35 years. And the cost of that program, for a quarter of that cost, you could get the same amount of generation out of the renewables. So our point is that let's forget about the probability of a disaster or mining on native lands. But the real issue is money. These things don't make sense. So if Trump really is the businessman he claims to be, going down nuclear power is like throwing money down a black hole.
And on top of that, what we're moving forward to at Fairwinds is focusing on decommissioning and to do it right to protect our waters, our food supply, the aquifers, the rivers, from the leaking plants. As you said, they're aging. They're aging drastically, and we want a clean solution. And that means focusing on putting away the waste, taking the plants down, and decommissioning properly, and moving to clean energy.
In the next 10 years, as many as 30 nuclear power plants are going to shut down because they just don't make economic sense. And what are we going to do with them? You know, there's no real plan to protect the community. Diablo Canyon is a great example of forward-sighted policy where they're trying to protect the community and they're trying to protect the workers. At the same time, they're trying to divest from a 40-year-old nuclear power plant.
Well, Arnie Gunderson, Maggie Gunderson, it's always good to have you on the Project Censored show. Fairwinds Energy Education, the website is fairwinds.org or Fairwinds Energy. You can email them as well at Maggie or Arnie at fairwindsenergy.org to find out more about what they are doing. And I have to say, it's always a pleasure to have you on the Project Censored show because you talk to us about these important issues regarding nuclear power and nuclear energy and nuclear weaponry in ways that the corporate media will never do. And of course, we have two major stories in our top 10 in the 2017 book this year on carbon dioxide levels and another on Fukushima. Another update on Fukushima with no end in sight, and we certainly will look forward to having you both back on the program to talk more about that as the Trump presidency settles in. So thanks so much for coming back to the Project Censored show.
Thank you, Mickey, and thanks to everyone at Project Censored. We really appreciate it. Bye.
That was a conversation with Arnie Gunderson and Maggie Gunderson of the Fairwinds Energy Education Organization. We were discussing energy policy and nuclear power in a Donald Trump presidency.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
That does it for the Project Censored show today. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. You can learn more about Project Censored Radio at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. Our producer is Anthony Fest. Erica Bridgman is our engineer. Thanks to all of you for listening. We'll see you next time.
Habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fall for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity citizens. And the times for the master thief, confine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu.
We got that love, we flip the brothers in our